If you wanted to look up some material on Judaism, you might go to the public library, and there you would find the material listed on the shelves under the classification of religion. I teach in Case Western Reserve University in the Department of Religion. And the activities of this congregation are protected by the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, which says very simply, the Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. By convention, by consensus, Judaism is a religion. Religion is one of those words which everybody uses, and almost everybody uses with a different signification. And because so many judge the special entity, in this case Judaism, by the larger classification, I thought it might be well this morning if we spent a few minutes with no other purpose than to try and understand this phenomenon known as religion. When I begin a class in the university, I ask the youngsters for their definitions, and some tell me that religion is a superstition. Others tell me that religion is simply the mystification of that which we don't yet understand. Others tell me that religion is all that's good and valid and valuable, a consecration of belief. I found that over the years that all of us carry some prejudgments around with us about this word. And prejudgment is just a nice way of saying prejudice. For some, religion represents all that is good, valid, and valuable. And they're prepared almost willy-nilly to support anything that goes under the general title of religion. I remember a businessman who told me once that he wouldn't hire anybody who wasn't religious. And there was an ad campaign some years ago, which you may recall, where the basic line was, "The family that prays together stays together." On the other hand, there are those who believe that religion represents credulity, that it's pointless, that it's an illusion, that it represents an attempt by some crafty ecclesiastical body to impose a mystification upon the society, to take their minds off of the real problems so that they are not liable to attack the privileged and the established. They see it as a glorification of the unknown and the unknowable and as unnecessary and sometimes downright evil. What then is religion? And I approach it rather not so much simply to find a dictionary definition, but because I'd like to find a way to clear away some of the confusion. So then we come to think about Judaism, our religion, we can do so without prejudgment, looking on it as it is for what it is, and not bringing down to it some of the prejudices, good or bad, which we have because of the general classification. My first point would be this, that religions existed long before anybody knew there were such a thing as religions. That religions are co-evil with any and all social orders. Any group, clan, tribe, family, community, country, nation, any group which is cohesive, which shares a single culture, has a religion. One way of suggesting this to you is etymologically. The Hebrew word for religion is dat. Most of you have either spoken the word or had the word spoken to you because it's part of the wedding formula of our tradition. Hare at mekudeshet li betaba'at zu kedat, Moshe v'Yisrael. Be thou consecrate unto me by this ring according to the dat, according to the practices, according to the religion of Israel. Now, if you turn to the Bible, you'll discover that though we think of the Bible as a great repository of our religious tradition and as basic to the religious traditions of the West, in point of fact, the Bible does not know the term. The word religion, in its general sense, does not occur in the Bible. The word dat occurs only once, that is, in only in one book, in the book of Esther. The late scroll, which comes out of the Persian period, probably from the 3rd or 2nd century before the Common Era. And it's used there in the sense of a royal decree. When Esther says that she'd like to invite Ahasuerus, the king, and Haman, the prime minister, to a banquet in her chambers, she's told by her advisors that she may not enter the royal audience chamber uninvited, because this is the dat, this is the official imperial practice of ancient Persia. Over the next few centuries, the word dat came to be applied not only to imperial decrees, but to the decrees of the King of Kings, that is, to God's own decrees. And we find in the Mishnah, in the great 2nd, 3rd century of the Common Era code of Jewish law, in a section known as Ketubot, which is a section which deals with the marriage contract, with the ketubah, with the terms of the contract and the stipulations of the contracts and the ways in which this contract may be dissolved, we find there the phrase that there are, the idea that there are certain women who, if they are divorced, cannot claim the what is stipulated as theirs in the marriage contract because they have violated the dat of Moses, that they've violated the Mosaic law, the Yahudit, and the customs of the Jews. And in the slightly later law code, the Tosefta, this phrase is simply changed into dat Moshe v'Yisrael, the phrase in which it comes down to us in the marriage vow. So by the 2nd or 3rd century of our era, the word dat has come to mean the sum total of the God-mandated religious practices of the Jews. Now, in the Greco-Roman world, travelers, academicians became conscious of the difference between the religious practices of the variety of tribes and peoples. They were not so much conscious as differences of belief as they were in differences of forms. And they used this word religio, which means simply that which is tied down, that which is bound together, almost the same thing as dat, to describe the practices of a given community. And since in the ancient world all practices were as wide as the culture and all had the sanction of the god or the gods, some sanction of the numinous, of the holy, the sacred, they were in fact defining religious practices, as we use the term today. And so in the Gemara, the second of the major law codes of our people, the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries of this era, we find the word dat used in the sense of the separate religious traditions, separate set and codes of practices of various peoples. In the ancient world, when someone intermarried, they took on the laws and the practices of their husband. And so the Talmud uses this phrase dat to describe someone who ma'bir badat, who changes her dat, who changes the law by which she is governed. In other words, apostasy is defined in this way. And we now have a term which can be applied to a number of different religious sets of practices. There is a phenomenon, a set of practices which is declared to be sacred and consecrated. And then slowly men begin to discover that there are similarities of form, at least, between one such set of practices and another such set of practices, and the word religion, the word dat, emerges. It emerges then to define custom, practice, sacred practice. And in the Middle Ages, because of the ubiquity of Christianity in Europe, those who wrote dictionaries began to define religion, the word which the Greco-Roman world had used for our word dat, as faith in God, particularly faith in Christianity, faith in the Christ. less, their focus now is less on the practices and the customs as it is on the body of beliefs. And in the age, during the age of discovery, as the travelers went out from Europe and they discovered here and there and everywhere shrines and temples and worship and hymns and scriptures and religious forms, holy men of all kinds, they began to use this word religion to describe Hinduism, Buddhism, the Confucian tradition, the Jain tradition, Islam, Judaism, as well as Christianity. And they began to describe, as the ancient Romans had, they began to describe a set of forms, temples, shrines, scriptures, sacred traditions, priests, ecclesiastics, holy men, magical rites, sacrifices, prayer services, and the like. And this has been the general definition of religion down to quite recent times. But as we began to examine that shopping list of religions which were described in the 18th, 19th century dictionaries, particularly as we began to lay the classical religions alongside the more primitive religions, we discovered that it was hard to find a common denominator among all these religions. Some religions had a written scripture. Islam has the Quran, Christianity has the New Testament, we have the Tanakh, the Torah. But others have only an oral tradition. Some religions have sacred buildings, pagodas, stupas, shrines, temples. Others have no such religious building. They worship in the open air. Some have holy men and shamans, and some simply have men of learning. Some have hymns and sacred dances, and some worship in absolute silence. And so it was hard for them to find a definition which would encompass all those phenomena which somehow were recognized to be religious, but did not share always the same set of forms. And so a new question was asked, a much more important question. And the question had to do not with form, but with function. What is the function of religion in the social order? Why are there religions, in effect? What basic human need does religion represent? And here, the answer became increasingly clear. Religion represents the attempt by men, by people, to consecrate, to declare sacred, to declare valid, to declare useful and meaningful, a certain set of values, a certain vision of life, a certain set of promises about the importance of certain kinds of actions. Religion allows life, with all in all its variety and all its confusion, to become coherent. Religion is the way by which a group declares its set of ethics to be right and beyond question, declares its social structure to be appropriate and beyond question, declares its view of life and death and whatever lies beyond the grave to be right and without question. And so a more modern definition of religion is that which would be one of this order, that religion represents that cluster of ideas, of myths, of rituals, of ceremonies, of hopes, and of visions, and of institutions, by which a society, any society, confirms and affirms its basic attitudes towards life. We are born, after all, without any active decision in our part. We're born into a particular time, a particular place, a particular society. Its values may be congenial to our nature, or they may be quite uncongenial to us. We will die. And we do not control the fact that we will die. Accidents will happen to us. Illness will occur to us and to those we care about. We will be told to conform to a certain set of customs, of rituals, of promises, of family relationships. And again, these may be congenial or they may not be. We will ask questions about what was before and what is now and what will happen beyond. There's no way of proving that one set of values is better than another, that what we believe to be right is in fact right, proper, consecrated. And out of this need to transcend confusion, because confusion paralyzes, because confusion precludes sanity, out of this need to transcend, to get beyond the confusion which comes to us from all of our experiences, we hardly could make sense of all that happens to us if we didn't look at the world already with a set of ideas which try to bring everything that we see into a certain sharp focus. Religion is the way, the mechanism, the social mechanism, by which a society organizes and declares sacred its practices, its values, and its vision. Religion exists in all societies and all ways. And once we have come to this understanding of religion, I think some very important changes can take place in our approach to our own century, our own time, and our own religion. I know the professor, and when I was a student, college, a fine tutor of history, who used to say that religion has become an elective in modern society. And what he meant is that as you look out at the modern world, let's say America, you recognize that probably only one in two, half of the population, has elected to become a member of a religious body, a church or a synagogue. As you look at sociologically at our world, you recognize that there's developed what they call neutral space, that unlike the simple tribe or clan, the primitive society, where everyone was bound together by the same set of customs which were declared to be sacred, that is to be religiously consecrated, we are now governed by a secular rule. It allows us, if we come from different religious traditions, to come together and to meet without having to give up our identities or our freedoms. That we live in a world, in other words, where religion seems to be in a condition of diminishment. Once all people were Christian or Jews or Muslims, and now a sizable minority, if not a majority, in the West at least, declare themselves to be secularist, declare themselves not to be part of the classic trinity of Western religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. If, however, we look at religion in the way in which I have suggested, as simply the way in which a group, any group, consecrates, affirms and confirms a set of values and visions and attitudes, then it becomes clear that far from being an age in which religion is being diminished, this age of which we're a part is one of the great ages of faith that mankind has ever known, and perhaps the greatest century of belief that the world has ever seen. And I speak not only of the explosion of faith among in Islam, but I speak of fascism, and communism, and Maoism, which after all have made millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of converts, either by the force, the compelling force of their arguments, by the attractiveness of their customs and ceremonies, or by sheer force over the last three or four generations. My point is that no one can live without some set of beliefs which they feel defines life, shapes life, gives meaning to life for them. And one of the truisms about religious belief is that it becomes hotter, more desperately needed, the more the society is in a period of convulsion, a period of change. What is true is that the old traditional religions no longer are as universally compelling as they once were. But religion itself, as a phenomenon, remains as universal a human need as it has ever been. Now, I always have trouble convincing my university classes that communism, let's say, is a religion. It's anti-religious, they tell me, and they're right. The communist ideology believes that religion, which is defined in an old-fashioned way as Greek Orthodoxy, the Roman Catholic Church, Protestant Christianity, Judaism, that is, the traditional religious congregations of the West, they attack religion as taking men's minds off of their problems in this world, preaching deferred hope, Be patient now. This is life is a trial. You'll have reward, your reward in the world to come. Therefore, religion stands in the way of consciousness raising among the proletariat, among the peasants, among the workers, among those, all those who ought to be actively reaching out to transform the basic structures of the social order. Indeed, reaching out, being politic, is looked upon, according to the Marxist doctrine, by the religions as a sin, because one ought to be patient under the chastening of the Lord, one ought to render unto Caesar the things that belong unto Caesar, and therefore, religion is held to consecrate, privilege, and to be a useful tool of the elite classes. Now, obviously, there is some truth to the charge that the socialist and communist ideologues raise. But the truth does not go to the fact that they are anti-religious. They are anti a particular form of religious philosophy, of religious ideology. And they are in themselves a classic example of an authoritarian medieval religion. There is a truth, clear and spoken. Pravda means the truth. There is a sacred office which defines orthodoxy and condemns heresy. There is an inquisition which sends the heretics to Siberia or to the Gulag Archipelago. There are the ecclesiastics, the cadres of the Communist Party. There is a scripture, Das Kapital, and a Rashi, Lenin's commentaries. There is a messianism, an inevitable materialist definition of history. There are iron laws which say that history must work out a certain way until in the end of days there will be the dictatorship of the proletariat and the ultimate withering away of the dictatorship, that period of justice for which all men long. Communism has spread in the same way that Christianity spread through Europe by the conversion of the leaders of the society by force or otherwise, and then by control of the educational apparatus of the state, so that there is a church-state relationship which is clear and critical. There's no separation of church and state in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe. Communism is not simply an economic ideology. It's a religion, a cluster of ideas, institutions, visions, rituals, myths which consecrate, affirm, and confirm a certain set of values. But those of us who live in the West, who see about us not an authoritarian ideology, but a lot of people who are simply indifferent to religion, simply do not belong to a church or to a synagogue, a lot of us wonder how I can say that everybody has a religion. And here I should tell you that scholars have for several generations now been defining what they call the civil religion. That is, they are saying that in a country like the United States, there is a set of ideas, perhaps there are many civil religions, but basically there's a set of ideas which everyone tends to agree with, to affirm and confirm a certain set of values. What are these ideas? These ideas are that there's a scripture, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. There are certain sacred patriarchs and saints, Jefferson and Lincoln and Wilson, Roosevelt. There are all kinds of commentaries on the scriptures, the decisions of the Supreme Court and the other courts of the United States. There are the holidays, the 4th of July and Thanksgiving. There are a certain set of confirmed and affirmed values, those of freedom, those of citizenship responsibility, those of truth speaking, of being able to shape one's destiny, of et cetera, et cetera. That in every way, there is a civil religion which consciously or unconsciously almost everyone in America belongs to. That is to say, there is no way of affirming, of confirming the fact that freedom under law is an appropriate social norm. We think it's right. We consecrate our lives to it. We will defend it. But there's no way of proving A, B, C logically that this is the most appropriate and proper form for human organization. Yet we believe it is, We consecrate our national life to it. We consecrate civic energies to make it work. We are halfway convinced that ultimately the rest of the world will come to understand this. We too have our messianism. It's not as confident and as certain as the communist ideology, but it has to do with the spread of prosperity and of freedom and of equality and of justice around the world. And more or less, we tend to feel that ultimately, through technology or otherwise, the underdeveloped countries will develop, and as they develop, they will take on the forms which we have found to be successful, and that ultimately one world will emerge, a world in which we men will have justice and freedom and not simply an enforced justice. The civil religion, communist and socialist ideologies, religions, those who believe in fascism, a religion. This is a religious age because it's a confused age. It's a convulsed age. It's an age where all of our values are being questioned. Questioned because we are now aware of the multitude, the multivarious cultures which exist in the world. We know now that they're really deep down, that there's no way of simply affirming what we believe to be right as right, because by God it is right. Confused because the challenge which is coming at us is a challenge which seems to be a challenge of the past, not a challenge of the future. The challenge of authority rather than the challenge of freedom. Because all of the matrices of our lives, our sense of self, marriage, family, responsibility, citizenship, all of these matrices of values, how we do these, how we fulfill these duties, are being questioned in the maelstrom of modern urban mass life. Briefly then, religion exists because we can't do without it. Because we would be paralyzed, unable to act, if we didn't have a certain set of coherent values which we believed to be sacred, to be consecrated, to be holy. How do we prove that they're sacred and consecrated and holy? That's the rub. It used to be that all we had to say is God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai and 600,000 people were there and they all heard God's voice and there was no doubt about it. But we know now that every religion has a myth of this kind which claims to affirm and to confirm and authenticate its religious truths. There are religions, obviously, which still maintain that theirs is the way and the only way and the sacred way. And all must ultimately come to it. Medieval Islam is claiming that again. The Roman Catholic Church takes this position. There are other traditions which are more willing to abide by the fact that every tradition has its sacred and surprising and special message, and it's functional in the sense that the society is organized around it, couldn't live without it. And that we live in a multivariate society, and therefore we will always live among people who, because they believe their message is right, will have difficulty in appreciating the value of our message, but will somehow, if only grudgingly, allow us our right to our beliefs. Religious faith is a very difficult thing to maintain because it's ultimately imperialist. I have to believe that what I believe is right. And therefore, it's very difficult for me to believe that what you believe is right is necessarily and inevitably so. That's the problem in our world politically. It's not simply a war of competing national entities wanting freshwater ports or oil, or it's that too. It's a war of competing religions. Someday, when historians write the history of the 20th century, they're going to write it in the same terms that we now write the history of the 17th century, is a century of religious wars, of wars between competing ideologies which refuse to understand or to accept or to tolerate the existence of heresy, of opinions opposed to their own. Religion is functional. It is elemental. You can't do without it. Which means that those prejudgments we bring to religion, that religion is good, or religion is superstition, or religion is evil, are meaningless. All religions are functional, but all religions do not necessarily serve a valid, humane, and beneficent function. Religion is. And religion must be judged like anything else in life by its consequences, by its impact on the people who belong. Are they turned in themselves? Are they blind to other truths? Are they fanatic? And by its impact on the society at large. Is it imposing its teaching by force, by authority? Is it willing to allow breathing space to other traditions? Does it encourage the individual conscience or demand ultimate total submission to some kind of teaching and some kind of ecclesiastical authority? And that's the hardest thing to do with a religion, but the most necessary. That is to recognize that religion is universal. It exists everywhere at all times and always will. Therefore, to return essentially to where we were in biblical days, to look at the special case, whether it be a cult, whether it be an economic religion, a materialist religion, whether it be Judaism, whatever it be, and to judge it in terms of its impact on human beings. Has it made for good? Has it produced a fine, sensitive, intelligent, concerned citizen? Has it turned its citizens away from the sense of humanity or towards it? Has it tried to develop the mind or simply force the mind to submit to its demands? Religion must be judged by its consequences on its own communicants and by its consequences on the world. Because religion is a very, very dangerous phenomenon. Anything you believe in and believe to be sacred is something that you will not compromise. Anything you believe in and believe to be sacred, you will ultimately believe another person, your children, your husband, your wife, your family, your friends, your neighbors, your community, ultimately to believe in. It's very hard to accept the fact that another sentient, intelligent, sensitive, moral human being could in fact believe a religion which is not yours. And so religions use the sword, coercion of all kinds, in order to bring you into heaven, offer you redemption and salvation as they see it. Religion, my friends, is a need. Psychologists speak of a will to believe. We have to transcend doubt and confusion, stand on some kind of solid ground in order to be able to step forward vigorously into the future. Religions are functional. They knit together and bind together a society, a culture. Religions are dangerous. Religions are beneficial. And by their deeds shall ye judge them, and judge them ye must. Because religions can create the mass suicides at Jonestown. They can create jihad, the Muslim call for holy war, crusades. And they can create a Martin Luther King or a Schweitzer or Martin Buber, men of great spirit, sensitivity. Religions, each religion has its own unique form, and therefore makes its own very special impact on the world and on its social order. When we look then at Judaism, let's judge it for what it is meant to us, what it is meant to the world, and not by any preconception, prejudice about religion as such. Religion is not an illusion. Religion is not the quintessence of morality. Religion is no more and no less than the universal human need to feel that we stand on solid ground, that values that we believe in are right, that the things we do are consequential, that our lives are redeemed. And what is redemption? Redemption is simply the statement, what I do is necessary and valid and appropriate and will have some lasting consequence. Redemption is not necessarily the promise of life beyond. It's not yesterday being brought into the fold of true believers, but in a universal sense, redemption is what we all seek. We seek to feel, we need to feel, what we do is right and good and necessary. We have a good religion, fortunately. I commend it to you. I know you commend it to your families. But not all religions are good, and not all forms of Judaism are equally good. Religion requires a great deal of judgment and not prejudgment. And I've convinced you of that. I've accomplished all that I set out to accomplish this morning. Amen.